From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Comedian Liz Winstead didn't just co-create The Daily Show. Step back, and she looks like a ringleader in a time of bright, funny minds speaking truth to power. Once a girl from Minnesota who asked too many questions, she grew up and shipped out to New York, learned the comedy business and politics too. Tough, free-spirited, opinionated, she brought Stephen Colbert into the limelight, plucked Rachel Maddow up to prominence, stamped her vision of political satire on an era. This hour, On Point, comedian Liz Winstead. You can join the conversation. Does humor magnify truth? Is Liz Winstead the human code ring to a whole era of political satire? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We're going to dive into a life and career in this hour, but just the sound of her doing stand-up first. This was last June at a benefit for the Planned Parenthood, Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota Action Fund. Liz Winstead shared her thoughts on political attacks and an effort to defund the organization.
It's really about Planned Parenthood. And you know why? It's because Planned Parenthood has the word plan in it. I mean, just in April alone, there was 30 pieces of anti-choice legislation that passed in various state houses around the country. Just in April. And it's like, you look at them and you're like, I don't know where, like I look at Mike Pence and I think, wow, never did a man's name so accurately reflect his worth. It's a Pence joke, people. Not that great, but okay.
Comedian Liz Winstead joins me now from New York, co-creator of and former head writer for Comedy Central's The Daily Show, founding member of Air America, the short-lived progressive radio network. She co-hosted there alongside rapper Chuck D and Rachel Maddow. She's a contributor to The Huffington Post, The Guardian, MSNBC's The Ed Show. Her new book, a kind of memoir in essays, is Liz Free or Die. Liz Winstead, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Tom.
So are you it? Are you the one ring that binds them all? I mean, I read this book and it sounds like just about everybody in progressive speaking truth to power has come through your world. What's up?
You terrify me with that code ring. In fact, I wish I had that code ring. Yeah. That would be great.
You're it, Liz. You're it.
Well, you know, instinct is a crazy thing. How you're given these opportunities to push forward, and if you don't give up eventually, and if you stay on the path, you start meeting people who are creative. And, you know, we're all a little bit off, I think. And so if you can recognize the awkwardness and genius in somebody and say, you know what? I see something in you. Come with me. Let's see if we can't make something great. It's sort of some weird political, satirical version of Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. I got some curtains. I have an opinion.
Let's put on a show.
I've got a placard. Let's put on a show.
I know. I want to talk about how your life factors in behind this, but this is really interesting to me. And you write about how way back when you were kind of you were a girl who spoke your mind. And you were watching George Carlin, and a buddy of yours said, hey, you could do that. You could do that stand-up thing. If we remember George Carlin, we know that political humor has been around for a long time. But you brought something new to it. If we think about The Daily Show and Jon Stewart and Colbert and even elements of Maddow, Al Franken, and on beyond, this political humor, but with a particular tough eye on the media and kind of playing with forms of media, maybe that's where you're the author, Liz.
Well, I think, you know, when I was, when I first sort of, I'd always been sort of a political person. I'd followed politics. I was a person who studied feminist theory in college, and I had seen the wrongs of things in society, but I never incorporated it into my stand-up. And when the media really started growing and 24-hour news channels really started having their prevalence, you know, first it was CNN and then it grew and grew and grew, when I started observing how the media was sort of twisting our logic in our lives in a way that felt like they're making hard things seem almost like fiction. Like I remember watching the Gulf War launching before my very eyes on
with
a horrible blind date.
All the G-Wiz graphics and, okay, yeah.
Theme songs and there was bombs and it was green. And
timpani
everybody
drums.
Yes, and there was all of a sudden really hot people. And I was on this blind date with this guy and I was watching the screen and we all were at this bar and I remember thinking to myself, are they reporting on a war or trying to sell me a war? And at that moment, my blind date goes, oh my God, this is so awesome. And I thought, oh my gosh, one person sold. And it just set something off in me where I just started to rethink the way news was presented and the way that, they were giving me information. And I started dating Brian Unger, who was one of the first correspondents on The Daily Show, who had worked in news. And, you know, we would constantly laugh about the fact that if we were watching the news and there was a story about a missing child, he'd say, wait for it, Liz, wait for it. Pretty soon we're going to see some black and white footage and we're going to see a swing set. And then we're going to see a swing and it's going to just go by itself. Yeah. And then the music's going to start and we're all going to wonder where that little girl is. And we would laugh because it became so obvious. And he would like, he would say, you know, watch that guy talking and then just envision them bleeping him. He could be saying something lovely, but when you bleep at someone's mouth, it makes them look horribly guilty of something.
Right. It's a short step from there to the Comedy Central. Everybody's watching for a long time now. Here's just a little taste of that. Liz, stand by right there. This is just last week. The Daily Show host Jon Stewart took on the advocacy group North Carolina Vote for Marriage for supporting the constitutional amendment banning gay marriage on the grounds that the historic meaning of marriage would not support it.
Let's examine marriage's historic meaning. It is important to maintain marriage's historic meaning. What is marriage's historic meaning, by the way? Let me see if I can... look that up here. Marriage originated as a social construct that allowed family patriarchs to facilitate the transfer of chattel property, such as livestock or daughters.
Liz, that's just last week. Can you hear the DNA that you laid down for the Daily Show still at work?
You know, you really do. That's the argument that I love so much about this particular issue of marriage is like, you know, women were often just cattle, basically, who were traded. And
it's the historic meaning. Don't mess with it.
I know. But what I've never understood, now, if two people that you don't know who live in a state that you've never been to and love each other can somehow ruin your marriage, I think maybe you shouldn't be able to get married. It just seems like a crazy excuse to put on this whole situation. And, you know, people love to pick and choose the Bible. It's one of my favorite things to do when I hear them picking and choosing. It's like, well, it also says you shouldn't wear polyester with a cotton shirt. And yet a lot of those people that are on TV are wearing that very outfit.
I can see that the back in your Catholic upbringing, the priest may have had a little trouble with you. The Liz Winstead, the one who just wouldn't just go along, get along. I want to look into this whole trail of kind of era that you brought forward, but take us back to some of that. Liz, I mean, what was it about you in Minnesota, Nice, Minnesota, in a family, what do you call it? A family, the Costco of procreation. what made you put a thumb in your eye, girl?
Maybe it was in my immediate family, I'm the youngest of five kids. Mm-hmm. In my extended family, just on my mother's side, I'm the second youngest grandchild of 27. So I think for a lot of people take this comedy leap trajectory where they see somebody on TV and they're like, oh, I loved watching Saturday Night Live or I loved watching this and I wanted to follow the comedy path. Truth be told, I just wanted to find any avenue where I could complete a sentence without being interrupted. And so as a little kid, the only like two places I really saw that happening were, you know, when I would see musicians and or priests, and I was so jealous of priests. I would go on Sunday, and I would sit in the pews, and I would watch the priest get to say whatever he felt like. Of course, I was barely listening to what the message was, but
he was up
just
there,
going
up
on
front
on.
In the spotlight.
Yes, and everybody, whether they were wrapped or not, looked like they were. And then after he was done and he came down, everybody shook his hand and told him how wonderful he was. And I was like, oh, what must that be like? Maybe I should try to do that. And then
we're going to try and figure this out. Envy the priest, create the Daily Show. Let's get a call right here. Lisa in Broadway, Virginia is calling. Lisa, you're on with Liz Winstead.
Thanks so much. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And hi, Liz. And I just wanted to say thank you to Liz for having the vision to spur this movement on. It is the only way I can listen to the news and watch the news without getting sick.
You're talking about satirical news, Lisa.
But it is satirical news, but it's always dead on point, and it always raises the big issues of the day, and it you know, pokes right at it and says, look at the real truth behind what you're being told. And I love it.
Well, and I think one thing that I love about what John has done with the show is when we initially launched, if I could make the comparison, it was more in the vein. John wasn't the host, and it was more in the vein of Colbert, where we didn't have anybody as sort of the voice of the viewer. We, you know, everybody was in character, and so it was kind
it's
of
all send up.
All send up. Mm-hmm. And so what I love that John has done is, and I always say to people, you know, fact check The Daily Show. You're not going to hear a whole, you know, you'll hear opinion, obviously. But if you fact check what they lay out, it's just as fact check worthy as I would say anything on cable news. But you're right. There is a thing that happens on The Daily Show where when they present to you some irony or some hypocrisy, it leaves you asking questions of yourself and wanting to figure out more. And that's the thing that it does. On top of making you laugh and giving you a catharsis, it does make you go, oh, my God, if that person said that once, I'm going to see how many times they've said that or whatever it is that spurs you. But it carries on the conversation rather than shuts it down. And I think that's a big difference oftentimes between somebody who is snarky and people who do satire really well. It's you keep the conversation going rather than saying something that might be funny but is also cruel and just kind of shuts things down.
Lisa, thanks so much for your call. Liz Winstead, we're delighted you are with us. The new book, it's a kind of memoir in essay form. She calls it Messays, or me essays, Messays. Liz Free or Die. She joins us from New York. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour with comedian Liz Winstead about her Speak Truth to Power School of Humor and Life in the Political Comedy World. Her new book is Liz Free or Die. She joins us from New York. Here's a little bit of her. In 2007, at the New York Stand-Up Comedy Club Comics, Liz Winstead probed American culture and the contradictions that can happen between humor, entertainment, and moral conviction using the case study of Dateline's To Catch a Predator.
I saw a woman with the writing on the butt, and instead of juicy or pink, it said legal. Yeah, really, is that where we're at as a society, that we have to give pedophiles a heads up now? I mean, honestly, it's really, it's very upsetting. I think Dateline Predator has done that to our society. It's true. Do you watch Dateline Predator? Of course you do. Yeah. It's an epidemic, Dateline Predator. It is, because remember the first time you watched it, and you were like, oh my God. I cannot believe there's an hour of television where we're watching hundreds of men going to a suburban home after trolling for young women on the internet. And then you watch the second time. You're like, man, that's hilarious!
Liz Winstead, in the midst of her stand-up, you can see her fingerprints all over the place these days in Stephen Colbert, Rachel Maddow, Jon Stewart, and many more. Listen right here. You'll hear an echo of her. This is just last Wednesday. Stephen Colbert's take on President Obama's endorsement of gay marriage on Comedy Central's The Colbert Report.
This afternoon, your marriage started feeling a little weak, didn't it? You got a sudden urge to abandon your family and go antiquing up at the Cape. And it's all because today, Barack Obama became the first sitting president to push the rainbow button and launch Gamageddon.
Gamageddon, Liz Winstead has the ring of power here that's brought it all around. Her new book is Liz Free or Die. Liz, a lot of callers for you. Jeff in Charleston, South Carolina. Jeff, you're on with Liz Winstead.
All right. Hey, Tom. I just want to say love your show, and I want to give some great props to Liz. I mean, I think the whole thing of speaking truth to power, whether it's Colbert, Daily, goes back, I mean, through Will Rogers, Mark Twain, and it really just gives the people some hope, because we all can't stand up there and say to these people, you know, you guys are full of it, and we know it. And so the people that do that, like Liz, and through that, just really are, I think, an important part of the democratic dialogue. And, you know, without that, I think the majority of us would just feel lost in the dust somewhere.
Hey, Jeff, I appreciate your call. Liz, do you feel yourself in that tradition? Mark Twain, Will Rogers, I don't know, what river are you in?
Well, when we have the Liz Winstead Follies, I will be very excited.
Yes, no doubt.
But I, you know, to compare myself to those people, I would never do that. But I think the point that he really makes and that I try to do is, especially as we look at the landscape more and more, where we have more money in politics, we feel as individuals less and less in control. When I can get on stage and bring a voice to a regular audience full of people and say, you know what? We're not the crazy ones. This does seem very, very, very nutty. Here's how I will present it. Here's us laughing and taking a moment to at least reset. Because if you're still laughing, you haven't lost hope. And that to me is a really big thing. And my politics are pretty, I'm pretty open about it. I'm a fairly progressive person. And a lot of people say, you know, do you take on both sides? And what I say is, no matter who I might like, if there is hypocrisy that shows up, when whether it's a politician I may have voted for or somebody in corporate America, if you use your power for evil, you are my target. I don't spare anybody, but I also don't make a false equivalence when there isn't one. You know, if you don't believe in science, then guess what? There is no, well, let's have somebody on to counteract. You know, I can't. The science people are the ones that are worse. If you like science, I love you. You know, I will never forget watching one of the early debates of the Republican debates. And the question was asked, do you believe in evolution? And there was 10 candidates on stage and 3 raised their hand. And at that point, the moderator, who I think was Chris Matthews, should have just said, all right, you 7 can leave. And the 3 of you move in and now we'll have a real conversation.
Hey, but it's
reality.
Not his party. And those are Republican voters in some way just deciding ultimately who stays on that stage.
I know, but really? Yeah. But really?
Yeah, no.
I've been to the Creation Museum, and there's literally a plaque at the Creation Museum. They have a tenancy there, and I encourage everyone to go to the Creation Museum because it's a wonder. It is a wonder. And there is a plaque that – there's a lot of Eve blaming, shall we say, in the Creation Museum. A lot of, if she hadn't have eaten the apple,
only
this would have happened.
Tempted Adam, yeah, yeah.
Oh, my gosh, that Eve, boy. So one of the plaques said, before Eve ate the apple – childbirth was painless. And I said, all those babies that were born before Adam and Eve just came rocking out. It was like a sweet summer picnic. Rib and
yeah,
Rib.
Yeah, right.
Ribette.
Dust.
Dust and Rib. Right. You remember them, the lost children of the Bible.
Liz Winstead is with us. She's brought a lot of satire into politics and even in a way the news. Let's go to James in Brantford, Connecticut. James, you're on with Liz Winstead.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Just wanted to ask one small thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is your guest concerned that her satirical take on media and national politics has possibly cheapened the public's respect for national discourse and government generally? I mean, conservatives have been telling us for like 30 to 40 years that government basically doesn't work. And now we have this new class of sort of comedy journalists who point that out all the time. Isn't there a danger of making the conservative argument for them?
I don't, that's a really valid point. But what I think that it's never been my point or the point of any of the projects I've done to be the last word. But I think that when you point out to people, and again, I think to Tom's point, I talk much more about the media, you know, in tandem also with the government. But I think that when you ask people to look at why something is broken and you get them to react, and for the left, it seems to be they really do react to humor and pointing out hypocrisy, and that fuels people on. I think it makes people more engaged, in my opinion, less than engaged.
Are
I think
you absolutely
that,
sure? I mean, to James's point, you watch Jon Stewart roll his eyes every night at almost everything, and pretty soon, you know, or maybe we're all rolling our eyes at everything, and now you're engaged, but not, you know, what are you going to do?
Well, I mean, I guess you would have to show me some facts that bear out that people who are engaging in political satire are discouraging people from becoming active citizenry. I haven't seen that yet. I know that when I do comedy shows and I talk to people after my shows and I'm bringing 300, 400, 500 people into a theater in a night, they are talking to me afterwards about voter drives and what they're doing and how there's certain causes that they're jumping into and they seem really energized. So, you know,
and certainly the Daily Show goes on balance more after conservative or Republican tropes these days than Democrat or progressive, I'd say.
Well, and you also do not hear in my audience, largely I speak to are, you know, more probably to the left people. And I don't hear them saying, government's terrible, I'm rethinking everything, and I think it's useless. Where you do hear, you know, as the Tea Party has become a powerful source, and you hear Republicans and their budgets and what they're trying to do, it's all about government bad, government bad, government bad, government bad. So the same question could be asked of Rush Limbaugh and the sort of people who dabble from on the right in the sort of way that I look at things. Yeah. When you start blaming the government and saying they're useless for everything, I would take a look at them more than I would as the entertainers.
We've got a big audience responding to you right now. Liz Winstead's new book is Liz, Free or Die. Dana is calling from Brewster, Massachusetts. Dana, you're on with Liz.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you. Hi, Liz.
Hi.
You know, I'm a fan of The Daily Show, and I think it's great, and I think, yes, there is certainly... I really believe in satire. However, I'm a little concerned that comedy is that left-wing ideas are being relegated only to comedy, and as a result, it's just the media's way, and I'm sorry to say NPR too, of marginalizing or excluding intellectual left-wing voices like, say, Noam Chomsky or Naomi Klein, and just relegate it to the funny pages of The Daily Show. And, I mean, I've seen this pattern, especially in NPR, where genuine conservatives get a lot of time behind the mic, but genuine liberal or progressive voices are excluded.
Well, Dana, I got to speak up for Range right here. Noam Chomsky's been here several times, and I think he's on his way again. Paul Krugman just a couple of weeks ago, and many others. But point taken, I mean, Liz, what about Dana's concern that, okay, you may hold that torch, but do you end up relegating serious left-wing conversations to the funny pages, Dana says?
Well, I mean, what I would say is it is not the fault of The Daily Show or of political satirists that we are the ones who have taken or have been given the torch. We didn't ask for it. You know, I think what happened was, and to his point, which I think is completely valid, you know, when you look at just talk radio, it's like 96%, I think, conservative talk and something like 4%, you know, progressive or liberal talk on the radio wave. So there's a complete imbalance. But what I would also say, too, is when you watch corporate media, and I do for a living, you know, I have to listen to NPR and you know, community radio to be smarter, and then I have to watch corporate media to find out why Americans sometimes are a little confused. So when I do that, it feels like media used to be the watchdog of corporations and politicians, and that they now seem to be in bed oftentimes with those very people. And so the comedian's role has become watchdog of the watchdog, if you will. And so I'm happy to take that role on, but I don't think that saying, you know, you're blaming us somehow for being the only voice. We shouldn't be the only voice, and nobody thinks that's a good idea. I would always hope that people would look to us as part of their daily meal of getting information.
What about this? This is from TF, commenting, lots of comments online here, but he says, talking about Jon Stewart, he says, I wonder what you think of this, having been, you know, the co-creator yourself back in the day. Stewart has a bit too much of that, quote, needs to be in the middle, unquote, to him sometimes. TF writes, as I've said before, when the right wing trods on New York City, Stewart and his writers' best selves come out. There are a few other subjects they don't pull punches on. What do you say, Liz?
I mean, I guess I'm not really clear on what he means. You know, John has said, and I certainly don't want to speak for him, but he has said time and time again, you know, the goal, first and foremost, is to be funny. And so choosing targets wisely, have to be choosing targets that are targets that you can, that are full of, you know, material you can lay out, whether there's a lot of video, whether there's, you know, the hypocrisy to put out there. So, I mean, I don't think so. I think that the amount of pressure and the amount of relevance that people put on comedy shows should be a reflection of the dearth of good journalistic work that's on television.
Take us back to the beginning and what, you know, how did this happen? I mean, there you were in New York. You were famously back in your days of, you had your chair. You got to New York, planted yourself in the chair.
Yes.
And watched American television roll by seemingly like months on end. Had some revelation. And then comes a phone call, I guess, that begins The Daily Show.
Well, yeah. What happened was in one of my, let's call it intermittent crossroads of I'm having a really hard time figuring out how to make the political satire actually become something that I will have managers and agents support, because
right,
it was just too hard for them. You know, when you have managers who are, you know, managing people who blow things up and, you know, are saying sexist jokes on stage and being able to compensate for the amount of drinking that goes on in a comedy club. And then there's me saying, hey, I've got a new way of doing things.
Too nuanced. Too
they don't
subtle.
See beach. Mm-hmm. They don't see beach house in their future.
Beach house.
Yeah, beach. They see, you know, shack. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, supporting this one's going to get me in trouble. Mm-hmm. So, in watching, you know, the news and remember that the media landscape was incredibly different back in the early 90s. It was OJ days. It was baby shaking nanny. It was the evenings were just riddled with news magazines that would terrify you in a different way. They would find three different instances of some household product that might kill you. You know, your dental floss, will it strangle your baby? You know, right, anything that they could find.
Right.
And so it was, that was, and then the local news was very much if it bleeds, it leads, mm-hmm. you know, and there was children disappearing all the time. And so it was, and then forget about celebrities. Mm-hmm. Oh, if a celebrity got in trouble, it was on and on and on. And so I had started responding to those things in my act as well as, you know, the Clarence Thomas hearings were happening and as well as Bill Clinton, you know, running for president. And it was, so that was all going on at once. And as I was reflecting on that on stage and I was really developing audience for it, the good news is some of the people that had become executives at Comedy Central had started taking notice. And I had just worked on Jon Stewart's, his evening talk show, which had gotten canceled, and those executives, luckily for me, had moved over to Comedy Central. Mm-hmm. They wanted to do...
And you had worked briefly for Jon Stewart over there before, and then suddenly here they come and say, do something for us. You had an idea, but they had a better one for you.
Yes, and my dream had always been to kind of look at this media landscape and take it on. But it was always... I just always felt like it was a pipe dream that might come along eventually in my career. And so Madeline Smithberg and I, who had worked on Jon's show, mm-hmm. went to them. And we had the idea for this kind of silly show that was like the Larry Sanders show, but about an entire television network with horrible shows like a spoof of the show Friends, but it was all animals.
Okay.
You know, where like an Afghan was Letha Kudrow. It was as dumb as it sounds.
Okay.
So we pitched that to them and they, you know, patiently and listened and then said, you know, that's all cute. But what we really want to do is a show that's on every night that takes a look at pop culture and politics and the news. And my jaw dropped. And I was like, oh, my God, that's the show I want to do that I thought I would do when I was 40. So
you said, pinch me with the jaws of life.
Exactly.
Let me quote from your book, if I may, because you came on with Madeline a whole new way of responding to the news. We were not just going to make fun of the news and the talking heads that were everywhere. You're right. We were going to make fun of them by becoming them. We would operate as a news organization while acting like a comedy show. It simply had never been done before. And there you were.
And there we were. And that was and when Comedy Central heard that and they said, that's exactly right. And they did something that is so rare in television today. They gave us a year to develop the show. They went along with the notion that we're going to give our audience some credit. We are going to all just go out into the world and put on a broadcast that if the sound is turned down, there isn't a Ron Burgundy aspect to it. Mm. You know, it is, we all look like this is a news show. And when we would go into the field and we would run into reporters who would sort of say to themselves or have a look on their face like, I think these people are making fun of us. Where are they from? Because we'd get into the press gaggle. We'd ask Mike mm-hmm. McCurry questions mm-hmm. that were slightly off. And
the White House press secretary.
Yes, at the mm-hmm. time. And so it was incredible. And I remember we would pinch ourselves. I remember approaching Jesse Jackson in a gaggle. And I said, you know, Reverend Jackson, will you talk to The Daily Show? And he goes, yes. And I was like, really?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour with comedian Liz Winstead about her Speak Truth to Power School of Humor and Life in the political comedy world. Her new book is Liz Free or Die. Here's a little bit of Liz in 2007, her stand-up act. She took on ignorance and Islamophobia, asking the old question, why do they hate us?
I think the $64,000 question that stupid people ask is, why do they hate us? And quite frankly, I don't know why they hate us. I know why I hate us. But you know, there's all kinds roots of terrorism? You know, I mean, there's a bazillion different roots. And some of the things that people say, like they're jealous of our freedom, is not one of them. Yeah, they're jealous of, they are so f***ed off they don't have Applebee's and Queer Eye for the Straight Guy on their cable.
Liz Winstead, 2007. One of those she brought up, along the many she's worked with and framed up opportunities for, Rachel Maddow of MSNBC. On Monday, here was Maddow rebuking JPMorgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon for the $2 billion in trading losses there, and him saying, it doesn't look like just a one-time mistake.
He wants his company's mini meltdown on Wall Street to seem like a one-time deal, to seem like something that could never happen again, just a freak accident. Certainly nothing we need to take any precautions from stopping anybody else from doing. Certainly there don't need to be any rules stopping Wall Street firms from taking on that much risk again. They definitely don't need any new rules.
No rules needed. You can hear the little sardonic humor there, a little satire working right through with Rachel Maddow. Liz, lots of response online here. John says, Liz deserves her own temple. She's an inspiration. Thank you. You provide an invaluable service to our cultural evolution and demonstrate the power and importance of our sense of humor.
Wow, that's a little intense, considering yeah. I just spent the past 3 years writing a book, and at the end of it realized I had Oreo cookies in my bra.
What? What?
Oh,
why?
I went through, I was so terrified writing this book. Mm. I was so terrified, like when I would get inspired to write, because sometimes you just get off on your little tangents and your little self-doubt, that I would sit up for days on end. Quite frankly, I'm admitting this to you for the first time.
Okay.
In public, you know, I would sit on the couch and write and write and write. And then I would be up all hours and I would like, basically, it was sort of like back to the chair. I would just get meals delivered. I'd have a package of cookies by my side. And at one point, after like a 2 day or a 2.5 day bender of writing bender, I looked down at my bra and I realized, oh, I've eaten all the Oreos. And then I felt something and I was like, oh, there's some in my bra.
Hey, look
at that.
How fortunate. Opportunity.
And do you want to know what I did? I ate those. I'm going to admit it right to your listeners. I went
fleshy.
Right in there and ate them.
Great. Hey, while we're on that and we've got you, what do you make of the Time magazine cover everybody was talking about last week with, you know,
oh, you mean the one where the woman was breastfeeding her child on his way to the LSATs? Or?
Yes, exactly. What did you make of that?
Well, you know, it just seems so typical and trying to sell magazine-y. And what's interesting about attachment parenting is I don't know what happens after the kids are older, but I've seen a little bit in girlfriends of mine. And oftentimes I've seen narcissistic children who don't know how to detach from anything. And I have an issue with it. I don't have kids, so I don't want to think that I would know best. But I was surprised, actually, after seeing that. And seeing all the conversation that had taken place, I was surprised that Newsweek didn't have the same cover, except it would be Biden breastfeeding President Obama on the gay issue. You know, I think that I'm surprised they didn't just leap all over that and try to just steal its thunder.
There's an opportunity missed. Hey, tune in next week. Time magazine.
No
covered.
One asks me. No one asks me.
They will. Maybe Newsweek will grab it. Sage is calling from Calais, Vermont. Sage, you're on the air with Liz Winstead.
Hi, Tom. Great show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say The Daily Show is amazing and your work is amazing, Liz, but I had maybe a harder question for you in that there are so few women represented on The Daily Show. I haven't watched it in a little while. I've watched it seriously for about 5 to 7 years and loved it, but I was just irked that there only seems to be one maybe token reporter that they have, and that there are so many talented, really funny women out there, and what your perspective was on that.
Liz, did you set up a boys' locker room?
Well, you know, I haven't been at the show in a whole bunch of years, so I sometimes feel uncomfortable speaking about the choices that The Daily Show makes now, but what I will say as an observer is there is, you know, Samantha Bee, there's Kristen Schaal, you know, there's, you know, Olivia Munn, there was Beth Littleford. The show is on 4 nights a week. So one in 4 nights out of those week, there's usually a woman on as a reporter. And the thing about, there's only so much you can do in the course of a week. And so I often, when I hear that, I think, you know, there's a different guy on. If you want to have your white guy reporter and your person of color reporter and your woman reporter and, you know, all of a sudden the slots are taken. You know, there's one slot every night to have your reporter on. And so you know, once a week, there's usually a woman on. So I don't.
I can hear a lot of women grinding their teeth right there. You got. There's only so much you can do in a week. I mean, come on.
Yeah,
that's five nights.
You have
right?
It's four nights a week,
four,
and it's
right.
30 minutes.
Yeah. Okay.
And so when you look at the way that a format is broken down, I don't know where you have extra time for extra things and extra people. I just. Quite frankly, I don't. I've always heard that argument, and there are certainly a lot of really incredibly amazing people and women. And you, but when you look at a Daily Show audience, I compare it or should the Daily Show. It's very different than other late night shows. You know, the people that are on it, just there's not a lot of people who pursue politics and comedy altogether, just because there's not very many outlets for it. And that's it's such a unique show. To work on and write and to put on every day because your staff has to be really informed about politics and have a historical knowledge of it a lot of times, then be funny, then be able to write in the tone of the show, then be able to have a bunch of improvisational skills that you can pull all of that stuff that you know about politics and history out. And it does, gender aside, there's just very few people that do that.
But can we circle back just for a minute to the heart of Sage's question? Because here you are with a whole lot of work and years and accomplishment under your belt, but you've gone through all this as a woman, and she's kind of speaking in comedy. You could say the comedy, the Daily Show, or more generally. I mean, it looks, you've got Sarah Silverman who sat in your chair and did the Aristocats, and you've got plenty, but still it looks like there's something. Is there something about comedy that lends itself more to men, or is it about the industry or those beach house focused agents that make it easier for men? I mean, what about women overall in the biz?
Well, you know, in the biz, that's a whole different kettle of fish. You know, she asked specifically about the Daily Show. And when I look at it, that's just having been there, having seen the amount of people that come in and out that may be hilarious, but aren't necessarily in tune. And the thing about stand-up, that's an interesting thing is, and then I'll get to your question, is that when stand-ups form their acts, you become very ingrained and immersed in the persona you have created. And sometimes it's really hard to break out of that and then start writing for someone else, a totally different tone and a totally different thing. But as far as the industry at large, the good news is that I have seen it change from when I have started to now. As younger producers have taking over shows, you know, there's more female writers now on The Daily Show than there was when I was there. There wasn't any. And Jimmy Fallon has more writers. Some shows don't have any. But when you, when now that comics and comedy producers and writers have come up from the beginnings with women as their equals, they have now seen a different ballgame and a different path, and they look at women in a whole new way. And I think that's good. But we still have some old guard running things. There's still some questions I have, and it's still massively frustrating that there still isn't a strong woman in late night hosting a show. I don't understand that, and it's maddening. And you know, that's I just hope people don't quit and stay in it and forge ahead and start creating a whole new way of being recognized through YouTube and their websites and Funny or Die and all these amazing things that have started happening with. When you look at Kristen Wiig and Tina Fey, and there's just a million wonderful women who are finally being recognized and who are making films and shows that are bringing a lot of women on board. It's pretty great.
How did you end up bringing up Rachel Maddow?
That is a very great story. So I was trying to, with my dear friend Shelley Lewis, we were trying to format 18 hours of radio programming on Air America. And I had a show also that was going to be from 9 to noon, and Chuck D was already on board. But as we got mired in the sea of developing an entire network, I still didn't have that big brain smart co-host that we needed to round it out. Because to go back to everybody's questions and points, the one thing I didn't want to have happen or that we didn't want to have happen on Air America was that there was a funny person necessarily driving the show. We wanted brains to drive the show, and we wanted color commentary to be able to give everybody a little bit of what they, you know, a little bit of a lift. So we couldn't find a host, and there had been some people suggested to me that I just was like, I don't think so. You know, how about Jerry Springer? How about not?
Oh, wow.
And so one day I got a call from an old dear friend of mine, and he was my dear gay best friend in New York for like 10 years. And he had done what So many of my gay friends have done. They move to Western Massachusetts and they find a partner and they have a farm and they invite me to come and go apple picking and go on hikes, and I always say no, I'm not coming. I have great friends up here, you'd love it. I'm like, yeah.
No,
does it involve hiking?
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
So when I got the Air America job, and as anybody who works in broadcasting knows, the second you get in a hiring position, you get calls from everyone and your grandmother saying, I know a person who's really talented. Will you take a look at their reel? And normally that person is not really talented. And normally it's like, oh, how do I avoid this? Mm. So I got the same call from Paul saying, I have this friend. She has a radio show up here. She's really talented. She's tried to get a hold of Air America before you ever got there, and nobody ever called her back. Will you listen to the thing? Yes, Paul, send it to my personal address. Yeah. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
So I get it in the mail, and I look at it amongst a whole bunch of Christmas cards, and I assume it's just a Christmas card from Paul, and I throw it on the table. And I walk out the door to work a couple days later, and I see it peeking out from my mail, and I was like, oh, no, that's not a Christmas card. That's that demo Paul sent me. I'll bring it into work.
Yeah.
So I walk in, and I say to Shelley, this is from my friend Paul. He sometimes has good taste. Sometimes he's a disaster. I'm not guaranteeing anything, but at this point, what are we going to do? We have 8 weeks to find me a co-host.
Yeah.
We put on the demo. It's Rachel, and she's terrific. And we're like, she's awesome. And that clip you played from her, Rachel had a spark in her. And what I often like to say about our radio show was, I always hoped that I was as smart as Rachel was funny, because Rachel was as funny as I was smart. Mm. And that's what made our show work so well, is that we never had any delusions. I never wanted to be Rachel Maddow. I never felt like, I want to have the ideas and be the smart one. I was so happy to have somebody come to work every day with this spark and with these ideas and finding these little kernels of stories where all of a sudden we're giving new information and I could just swallow it all up and then insert my commentary as we were having conversations about it. It was so great to have somebody make you smarter every single day on the radio. It was awesome.
You talked about how much of talk radio these days in this country is conservative, and that is very clear. Air America was an effort to balance that. There are all kinds of backstage reasons that maybe didn't entirely work out. But still, what about the different, manifest American public appetite for liberal versus conservative talk on the radio? What do you make of that?
Well, you know, what's interesting is, I believe the voices on Air America, when I look back on that lineup that we put out there, you know, with Mark Maron, who now is like the number one podcast going on right now, just a compelling, compelling person who is part political, part self-effacing, crazy, hilarious person. And then you had, you know, Rachel and Chuck D doing such great work, and Al Franken as a senator, and you have Sam Cedar, who's got an incredible podcast, and Janine Garofalo is off in her world.
But Air America's gone.
And Air America's gone. And so, you know, it was because we didn't, there was the money we were told was there when we all signed up wasn't there. So I don't know. The question is, what would have happened if Air America had been financially given the chance to allow these voices to thrive? And that never happened. And so that, not knowing that, I can't give you anything else, because I know that people loved our shows. I know that they did well. I know that, you know, they were not pulled off the air because we weren't doing well. They were, a lot of times it was because bills weren't paid in the major markets we were on in.
Yeah.
And so it's the $64,000 question. What would happen if people actually funded? Which, by the way, George Soros never gave us a penny. So anytime you hear some right-wing person saying, the George Soros funded blah, blah, blah,
you wish you had
a penny.
Let me get one more call. Sandy Hook, Connecticut. Adam, you're on with Liz Winstead.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My call is because I'm thinking about all of the things that have been said here about the role of comedians, and I think it's because the politicians who are on the position of the left, the whole dialogue has shifted so far right that the middle of America and the left of America finds no politicians who are really saying what we want to hear or talking about the issues that matter to us. And the comedians are the only people who are holding down the fort of what used to be considered the left 20 years ago.
Adam, let us take that, and I'll give it to Liz right there. But let me put it up against this one, Liz, if I may. This is a gray man, writes online. He asks you, he says, you know, hey, Liz, what left progressive hypocrisies does Liz Winstead tackle head on?
Oh, you know, I would say, you know, for example, I wrote a joke yesterday on Twitter where Mitt Romney keeps calling Barack Obama an old school liberal, an old classic liberal. And I was like, oh, really? I don't remember in the 60s when we had drone-ins. You know, I take on a lot of, you know, I question a lot about how Barack Obama took so long to find his place on gay marriage, you know, not closing Gitmo, negotiating before he gets to the negotiating table, you know, looking at our Afghanistan policy. I do a lot of jokes that involve where Barack Obama, you know, when he took office, what is the first thing he did after promising that he would have a generic prescription drug plan in the healthcare package? He negotiated to take that out. So I talk a lot about him and the Democrats and the spinelessness of how they dealt with the orcs that took over after the election.
Grayman, there's
one. Does that
one,
answer that, Grayman?
Yeah, I think so. There's one for you. Here's the last one. AT talking about the show you co-created, The Daily Show, says, loves it, though somehow I sense a quality in its humor that it's not unlike that felt in the anti-Nazi cabarets in Berlin just before the brown shirts and jackboots smashed the furniture. Ooh, is it gone there, Liz?
Well, you know, I have to do more research on Weimar Republic cabaret so that I could really answer that question. Right now, I'm not prepared to answer about Weimar cabaret versus Daily Show.
All right. But, A.T., you leave us with one to thank on Liz Winstead's new wonderful book of essays about a life in the biz and all the seeds she's planted along the way. Liz Free or Die is the book, excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Liz, it's been great to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.